Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right, from the CBC, we're going to open with an obituary. But hang on, this one is totally worth it. We're speaking specifically about an Australian blood donor who saved millions of babies thanks to a rare antibody. His name was James Harrison, and he died at age 88. He was known as the man with the golden arm, and he donated plasma 1,173 times in his lifetime.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. It's so much, in fact, that the Australian Red Cross claims that he was the world's most prolific blood and plasma donor.
Just think how long he could have lived had he not donated.
If only he had kept some of the plasma for himself. Well, here's another way to think about the scope of his impact. He donated blood every 2 weeks from age 18 in 1954 until he retired at age 81 in 2018. So he decided to become a blood donor after he himself was the recipient of several transfusions. He had lung surgery as a teenager. And soon after he began donating, they found out that his plasma contained the rare antibody known as anti-D. And this antibody is used to make the medication given to mothers whose blood is at risk of attacking their fetus. If they have a negative, like A negative or B negative, but their partner is positive, the immune response can lead to what's called hemolytic disease of the fetus and newborn, which is understandably abbreviated to HDFN.
So they're incompatible.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know that those children's, I mean, I guess it's been long enough now, all those children have grown up to be healthy adults?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because it's literally just a positive versus a negative blood type thing.
In utero.
Okay.
I didn't want to go to the, like, kill them all, let God sort them out, which is kind of where that sounded like it may have been going.
That's why I say, I mean, it was. It was, okay. Is there not a natural evolutionary play that was telling the body, maybe these shouldn't be in coexistence?
Well, honestly, what it really says is that you've got more positive babies being born, which is shifting the population toward more positive population members who don't have a problem. Positive mothers can have negative babies. It's just not the other way around. And so it's actually like evolutionarily, it pushes negative babies out. Like it gets rid of the negative mothers over time.
But one last fun fact for Mr. James Harrison, he harbored a lifelong fear of needles. Quote, I never once watched the needle go in my arm. So you too could have a golden arm. You too could have a phobia of needles, and you too could save millions of babies.
Well, yeah, there is definitely something to be said for he didn't know he had this. And there's probably a lot of other people with secret golden arms walking around who've just never been tested to see if they have any of the rare antibodies.
Test your arms, y'all.
Give them a little quiz.
All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from BBC, and it's titled The Hidden World Beneath the Shadows of YouTube's Algorithm.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So there's a secret side of YouTube just beyond the guiding hand of the algorithm, and it's nothing like what you know. The vast majority of YouTube's estimated 14.8 billion videos have almost never been seen until now. This year marks YouTube's 20th birthday. From its humble beginnings as a venue for amateurs, today YouTube is such a behemoth that the company calls itself the New Hollywood.
Ooh.
YouTube is the world's number one TV streaming service, where users clock billions of hours of watching every day. For comparison, an estimated 823 million cinema tickets were sold across all of the US and Canada in 2024, And meanwhile, Mr. Beast's most successful video alone racked up 762 million views, about one watch for every 10 people on Earth, which is a little sickening to think about. But, you know, I'm sure there's repeat watches and whatever. But that's the vision of YouTube that the company promotes. Through another lens, the essence of YouTube is more like a video from 2020. And there are links to a bunch of these videos in this article if you're curious. So before the author watched this, it had only been seen twice. A man points the camera out of his bedroom window as a flurry breaks out in the dead of winter. Here it is, he says, the falling snow. A bird lands on a nearby fence. 19 minutes go by. Nothing happens.
Oh, wow.
So Ryan McGrady is a senior researcher in the Initiative for Digital Public Infrastructure at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he says the conversations we're having about YouTube are based on an impoverished view of what the platform really is. When we just focus on what's popular, we miss how the vast majority of people actually use YouTube as uploaders and overlooking the role it plays in our society. So to unveil this side of YouTube, McGrady and his colleagues built a tool that dials videos at random. And there's an article to how they did this. Unfortunately, they have not made it available as a public tool or service, but the scraper tried more than 18 trillion potential URLs before it collected a big enough sample for real scientific analysis.
Ah, that's who watched my video.
Right.
Yeah. So, among the findings, the researchers estimate that the median video has been watched just 41 times. Posts with more than 130 views are actually in the top third of the service's most popular content. And most of these videos aren't meant for us to see. They exist because people need a digital attic to store their memories.
It's an archive.
Yeah. Now, I will say that I have seen recently YouTube's algorithm has been messing with pushing content that literally has just like 1 to 3 views. And while a lot of the time it's not content I want to watch, I do appreciate that. And I find it pretty impressive that they're just going for it. So,
yeah, or I've also noticed like a video from 8 years ago all of a sudden is getting suggested to me.
So Ethan Zuckerman, who leads the YouTube research as the director of the University of Massachusetts Initiative for the Digital Public Infrastructure, says, as researchers, we spend a lot of time with this stuff. It can be a lot like looking at people's personal snapshots. Most of it's boring, but sometimes it's poignant, even haunting. And every so often, you get something that feels incredibly revealing about how beings communicate. But Jermaine's favorite videos by far came from Bill, quote, the Woof Driver, Hellman. He's a 58-year-old working in real estate just outside of Baltimore, U.S., but that's not his passion. What Hellman really cares about is his dogs and the unique way he cares for them. You've never seen anything like this before, he says in one video, and Jermaine guarantees that he's right. Hellman has built over 50 custom-made vehicles that he uses to take his four huskies out for what he calls urban mushing. He uses social media to document their adventures on the trails of the eastern U.S., and it all looks a bit like dog sled races, except here the dogs are usually strapped to the side of his various slow-moving contraptions, recumbent bicycles, and electric dog-walking carts. He's posted more than 2,400 YouTube videos in the last 14 years, many of which include original rock songs. He puts in a lot of work, heading out with drones and groups of friends to document his journeys. Hellman's even paid for celebrity endorsements through the platform Cameo to promote his videos. But for all the effort, his channel often gets little traction, and many videos have views in the low double digits. Hellman says, I don't get a big audience a lot of the time, but that doesn't bother me. I was just so in love with how happy it made the dogs that at some point I thought I gotta share this. Maybe it'll inspire someone to take better care of their dogs, but really I use YouTube like the cloud so I have a place to document my adventures. YouTube doesn't pay the bills and the Woof Driver isn't selling anything, though he's happy to give you the dimensions if you want to build your own urban dog sled. So random YouTube usually doesn't look like the highly produced videos of Woof Driver, but he's good representation in one sense. The majority of these YouTube videos range from neutral to overwhelmingly positive, but the same can't be said for what rises to the top. Research suggests YouTube's algorithm amplifies negativity, reinforces stereotypes, and gives users little control over the content they don't want to see. It still doesn't matter how rare a damaging video is if it gets a ton of views, and harmful content remains a serious issue on YouTube. So the YouTube we talk about, full of celebrities, scandals, manufactured virality, is only part of the story. The majority exists in quiet moments, shaky camera work, and voices meant for no one in particular. The author, Jermaine, watched hundreds of these videos, and every one of them is public, but it's also clear that most people didn't upload this content for strangers. It was kind of like being let in on a secret. But watching it also felt like work compared to the doom scroll inducing entertainment you get from the algorithm. And eventually, Jermaine closed his tabs and went back to the YouTube homepage, the polished world of the corporate internet.
Wow.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be fun for a little bit, but the majority of people are boring.
Boring is where it's at. Entertainment is a lie.
Boring and sunshine. You can have both.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. This comes from SciPost. Chewing wood may boost memory and brain antioxidants. Study finds. Okay.
That's
we'll get through this.
Groceries are getting really, really expensive, but don't worry.
Yeah.
Let's go out there and chew on that log. It's log.
Yeah.
So chewing on moderately hard foods might do more than just break down your lunch. A recent study published in Frontiers in Systems Neuroscience explored how chewing different materials affects the brain and found that chewing on wood compared to chewing on gum led to a significant increase in brain antioxidant called glutathione. Previous research has suggested that the act of chewing can influence brain activity and blood flow. Sorry, all of those of us that have TMJ, it definitely hurts our brains too. However, exactly what metabolic changes occur in the brain when chewing has remained unclear. One area of interest is oxidative stress in the brain. Oxidative stress is essentially damage to the brain cells caused by harmful molecules called reactive oxygen species. This kind of damage is thought to play a significant role in the decline of brain function as we age. So to protect itself, the brain uses antioxidants, and one of the most important is this glutathione. Researchers in this study were curious if chewing, and specifically chewing materials of different hardness, could influence the levels of this protective antioxidant in the brain. They also wanted to see if changes in the glutathione were related to changes in thinking skills. To investigate these questions, the researchers recruited 52 healthy university students in South Korea. They divided the students into two groups, one that would chew gum and the other would chew small wooden sticks, similar to popsicle sticks. Before chewing began, and after 5 minutes of chewing, the researchers used a special brain scanning technique called magnetic resonance spectroscopy to measure the levels of glutathione in the specific region of the brain called the anterior cingulate cortex. The specific technique they use, and I love this name because it's also in all caps, is called Mega Press. It's got to stand for something, but it's particularly good at measuring this chemical. During the chewing task, participants were positioned comfortably and instructed to chew for 5 minutes. To keep the chewing consistent, they were asked to chew on the right side of their mouth at a rate of 1 per second, alternating between 30 seconds of chewing and 30 seconds of rest. One group chewed paraffin wax gum, which is a standard type of chewing gum used in research, and then the other chewed on the wooden tongue depressors. All participants also completed a cognitive test called the Korean Repeatable Battery for the assessment of neuropsychological state. And after analyzing the data, the researchers found some interesting results. First, they looked at the levels in the anterior cingulate cortex before and after chewing, and in the group that chewed wood, there was a significant increase in the glutathione levels after chewing. However, in the gum chewing group, no significant change.
And you said it was only 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Like, I could chew on a popsicle stick for 5 minutes, y'all. If that's going to give me a boost, heck yeah.
It kind of puts all the, like, pencil gnawing during tests and all those movies into context, too.
So the researchers examined the relationship between the changes in the glutathione levels and the performance on the cognitive test. And as was implied earlier, they found the wood chewing group was positively related to scores on immediate memory and store memory tests. This relationship was not found in the gum chewing group. So you can't chew gum and think at the same time.
It's big gum telling us lies, man.
I mean, it's basically implying that my dog is brilliant because she's constantly chewing on sticks. Like, I feel like there is sort of an evolutionary pressure there, right? Like, you have this instinct to kind of gnaw on something, and it's because your brain's like, yeah, I need that, please. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's making me think of, you know, back in the old days when you would just chew on a bit of straw or something like that, right?
Yep, those guys chewing on straw. girls were definitely known as the smartest people.
Right.
But the study has some limitations to consider, right? Firstly, all the participants were young, healthy university students in their 20s. So it's not clear if these findings would be the same in older adults or people with health conditions. Secondly, the study focused on just one specific brain region.
Mm.
And thirdly, the chewing period was relatively short. It's possible that longer chewing durations and different patterns of chewing could have different effects. So maybe 6 minutes, you get dumb.
Ooh, or you chew on your left side and now you're a psychopath. Like, who knows, right? Man?
Or like in the cartoons, you get an ear of corn and you go row by row and you solve like impossible math proofs.
There you go.
And it also only compared gum to wood. Mm. These obviously differ more than just hardness, like texture plays a role. So I'm an ice chewer. Does ice make a difference? Is it the wood in there? So, yeah, we're at the beginning of this study, but there will be more studies in the near future.
I can't wait until all the like high pressure school moms are like, stick that popsicle stick in your mouth and chew it. Like it becomes a thing.
Did you bring your chew sticks, honey? Do you have your chew sticks in your backpack?
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, I've got a fun one from AP News that's kind of reminiscent of the lost Bitcoin drive we talked about a few weeks ago. It's called Thieves Used a Stolen Card to Buy a $523,000 Lottery Ticket. The victim wants to share the winnings. So the victim in this case is being kept somewhat anonymous, but we do know he's French. And he's being identified in the French police records as Jean-David E for his last initial. And it was a couple of months ago that his bag was stolen from his car in the city of Toulouse, including his wallet with his bank card, as well as some other personal belongings. So Jean-David did what you're supposed to do and immediately called his bank to cancel the card, which the bank did, but they let him know that the card had already been used at a local convenience store. So Jean-David was like, great, we got a lead on the suspect. And he personally went to the store to ask the clerk what the thief might have looked like, which, let me just say right there, that's apparently a very French thing. I cannot imagine any American being like, oh, I'm going to hunt down the person who stole something from me. Like,
well, we just do it online.
Right, exactly. Like, we can harass somebody, but we're not going after someone who might be harmed. Like, that's crazy. Yeah.
Wow.
It's a European thing, right? Because you've taken something from them.
Right. There's the vengeance. But so the clerk was like, oh, yeah, I remember that sale for sure. He said it was two men who appeared to be homeless, and he remembered them because, among other things, they had purchased a lottery ticket, which they had scratched off right there at the counter and revealed a 500,000 euro jackpot, which would be worth just slightly more in American dollars. The shop owner said, quote, they were so totally happy that they forgot their cigarettes and their belongings and walked out like crazy people. So now, Jean-David has filed a police report for the theft, but he says he'll withdraw the complaint if the two anonymous men agree to split the winnings with him. To that end, he has hired a lawyer, Pierre Debusson, and launched a very public campaign in the news to try to find them.
Wow.
Because the truth is they're not going to be able to cash it themselves. They'll have to present the ticket in person to the state lottery operator. And if that happens, of course, they'll be immediately arrested. But Debusson says if they come directly to him, his client is willing to make a deal and they will get half the money with no criminal charges. He said in his news appeal, quote, you risk nothing and you would be able to change your lives. Now, it's not actually clear whether that's true, because aside from the question of whether they can trust Jean-David to keep his promise, some experts say that even if Jean-David himself is the one to present the winning ticket, prosecutors know what they know. So they might still try to seize the winnings as the ill-gotten gains of a crime. It's kind of like the French version of RICO is what it sounds like. They're like, yeah, we know this money belongs to the victim, but we can take it anyway because it's part of a crime. Anyway, presumably Jean-David and his lawyer are prepared to fight it if that happens. But in any case, unfortunately, time is not on their side because winning scratch-off tickets in France do expire after a certain period of time. Mm. So if these men don't come forward relatively soon, then that's it. The money's gone. Which I don't think they're going to come forward. I mean, maybe, but why would you?
No, I see the sketch, you know, get rid of it, just burn it, right? And he burns it and then like, oh, we just got rid of it.
Right. Please come turn it in. Yeah, I mean, that assumes they're even watching TV. Like if these guys are out living on the streets, they may not get word, you know?
All they have to do is trust the people with a lot of money saying, trust us, which has always worked out well.
Yeah. homeless people are typically treated very well by the wealthy. Next link.
Next link. Okay, from my modern net, Leonardo da Vinci. I know you think you know, but do you really know?
He and I go way back. We're buds. Yeah, yeah.
This specifically looks at the self-taught genius of Leonardo da Vinci. Listen, he was born out of wedlock, did you know? The son of a Florentine notary and a peasant mother, he shared a childhood with 16 half-siblings from his parents' respective families.
Wow.
Now, you might assume that a man whose conceptual designs inspired inventions like the parachute, machine gun, armored tank, maybe he must have studied at a big-time academy, but his formal education was surprisingly limited. His father noticed that he had some talent at a young age, and so he arranged for him to work in Andrea del Verrocchio's workshop during his adolescence. This was a master painter and sculptor, but he didn't have a lot of an education when it came to mathematics. He learned the basics of reading, writing, and arithmetic, but he only briefly attended what the article refers to as a local abacus school to study commercial arithmetic.
You got to know how to make change. Like, these are the important yeah, skills that exactly. we're sometimes lacking today.
Right, but it's mercantile math and none of this fancy, mm-hmm. you know, imaginary numbers calculus or whatever. So in the 1490s, as a middle-aged man, he finally obtained academic training in math by studying under a friend of his named Luca Pacioli. Then in the early 1500s, during his later years in Florence, he took an even deeper dive into scientific study. This is at the same time while he was taking art commissions, he was still working on the famous Mona Lisa. He was just like, yeah, I'm going to audit this high science class, basically. Mm-hmm. And his research included a lot of the stuff we're familiar with as his private notebooks, where extensive analyses of anatomy through human dissection occurred. This is where he did all his bird flight observations, detailed machine designs, and his journals clearly show his inventive mind with creations like hydraulic pumps, a steam cannon, reversible crank mechanisms, and even musical instruments. And even despite all of this research that he was just doing on his own time, because he did not have formal training in Latin or math, scholars of his time dismissed his work. This was just amateur hour for them.
Mm.
Because in part, his empirical method relied on observation instead of what they were doing, which is experiments or theoretical models. He was hands-on working on it. Now, his scientific methods did fundamentally differ from later figures like Galileo or Newton. In part, that's because he was a man of the Renaissance. So he was blending art and science and using his artistic background to observe and record details with incredible precision.
And all that out of a turtle. I mean, it's impressive. Like, you have to...
Well, they had a little boost from some sewer slime, but given right, the way right. things are going, you could be next.
Yeah, apparently later in his life, too, it was really difficult to get him to actually finish work.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's relatable.
I feel that. I don't blame him for that at all.
And some say he had dyslexia. I don't know about that because I was. They told me that when I was diagnosed. Like, well, Da Vinci had it, but I don't know how true that is.
Right.
But it would track.
Yeah, it would. All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from apnews.com titled, Private Lunar Lander is Declared Dead After Landing Sideways in a Crater Near the Moon's South Pole.
Aww. Like a turtle.
Yeah, like the title says, a private lunar lander is no longer working after landing sideways in a crater near the moon's South Pole, and its mission is over, officials said. The news came less than 24 hours after the botched landing attempt by Texas-based Intuitive Machines.
Oh, no.
So we're really going for moonshots, and they're not working well.
Right, right.
Maybe we need more than our intuition for that.
Yeah. Just like, use math, guys. Sorry. I know they tried. So, launched last week, the lander named Athena missed its mark by more than 800 feet, or 250 meters, and ended up in a frigid crater. Athena managed to send back pictures confirming its position and activate a few experiments before going silent.
And that's how they knew, because the pictures were sideways. They're like, who took this in portrait format, guys? Come on.
Yeah, no, there are actually pictures of it sideways in this article. Oh, like, nice. It's literally just the moon on a slant, and the Earth is in the distance there. Yeah, it's tragic. So NASA and other customers had packed the lander with tens of millions of dollars worth of experiments, including an ice drill, drone, and pair of rovers to roam the unexplored terrain ahead of astronauts' planned arrival later this decade. Mm. It's unlikely Athena's batteries can be recharged, given the way the lander's solar panels are pointed and the extreme cold in the crater. The company said in a statement, "The mission has concluded and teams are continuing to assess the data collected throughout the mission." The bigger four-wheeled rover never made it off the fallen lander, but data beamed back indicates it survived and could have driven away had everything gone well, said Lunar Outpost, the Colorado company that owns it. Which is, yeah, if it had gone well, it would have worked. Fine.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, it would have worked. Had it worked, it would have worked.
Yeah. So this was the second landing attempt for Intuitive Machines. The first, a year ago, also ended with a sideways landing, but the company was able to keep it going for longer than this time. Despite all the problems, the company's first lander managed to put the U.S. back on the moon for the first time in more than 50 years. Earlier in the week, another Texas company scored a successful landing under NASA's Commercial Lunar Delivery Program intended to jumpstart business on the moon while preparing for astronauts' return. Firefly Aerospace put its Blue Ghost lander down in the far northern latitudes of the moon's near side. And Firefly CEO Jason Kim reported Friday that 8 of the 10 NASA experiments on Blue Ghost already have met their mission objectives. It's expected to operate for another week until lunar daytime ends and solar power is no longer available. The south polar region of the moon is particularly difficult to reach and operate on given the harsh sun angles, limited communications with Earth, and uncharted rugged terrain. Athena's landing was the closest a spacecraft has come to the South Pole, just 100 miles away. That's where NASA is targeting for its first landing by astronauts since the 1960s and 1970s Apollo program, no earlier than 2027. The craters are believed to hold tons of frozen water that could be used by future crews to drink and turn into rocket fuel. Intuitive Machines has contracts with NASA for 2 more moon landing deliveries. The company said it will need to determine exactly what went wrong this time before launching the next mission. After the 15-foot Athena landed, controllers rushed to turn off some of the lander's equipment to conserve power while trying to salvage what they could. In both landings by Intuitive Machines, problems arose at the last minute with the Prime Laser navigation system. And their rocket-propelled drone, Grace, was supposed to hop across the lunar surface before jumping into a crater to look for frozen water. The 2 rovers from 2 other companies, one American and one Japanese, were going to scout around the area as well. NASA's ice drill was activated before the lander's batteries died, but was unable to penetrate the lunar surface as planned, given the lander's prone position. And flight controllers did manage to rotate the drill to prove it worked, and a companion science instrument collected some data, according to NASA. Several other mission objectives were accelerated, according to Intuitive Machines, and NASA paid $62 million to Intuitive Machines to get its 3 experiments to the moon. So this is maybe a hot take, but I personally am a leave the moon alone advocate. Like, just give it a break. You know, like, we went there once. We put the flag down. It's fine.
Yeah, but we didn't really name it the American moon. And now is the time, since we're bum rushing it, apparently.
Get to that alien moon base before everybody else does.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing is, like, I'm sure a lot of these guys have read The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And I think there's probably some truth to the idea that it's a militarily advantageous location because of our greater gravity. You literally can throw rocks. You have endless missiles. That is literally the plot of The Moon is the Harsh Mistress, is the moon, the people living on the moon are like, we don't have to make an effort to destroy you. We literally just chunk a rock in your direction. And by the time gravity takes a hold, you're in trouble. And like, I agree, we should not put a military base on the moon, but I think that's where we're going. Like,
yeah. So I think our only solve is it's time to blow up the moon.
Yeah.
If we can't have it, Nobody can have it.
Nobody can have it.
I hope that we just keep putting more and more landers up there that keep getting on their side, and we later come to find that they're just creatures that are just kicking everything over. Like tipping cows.
That would be awesome. Yeah. If somebody like shuffled up to it real quick and just kicked it and ran away. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include: scientists crack how aspirin might stop cancers from spreading, how the development of the camera changed our world, and CPR is not as successful as many think. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.